energy, utility, environment, and climate, and the environment, climate, and legacy committees. With me here is my co-chair, Senator Nick Frentz. And so we're going to be hearing from Xcel Energy about the Monticello power plant. It's a concern of the Senate, and I'm sure a concern of our citizen and resident here in the state of Minnesota as well. So I'm going to pass the gavel to my co-chair here, Senator Frentz. Senator Frentz, take it away.
Thank you, Senator Herr. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, members, for coming by this joint hearing. We're hoping to get some information out to the public. Part of our duty is to investigate and report, and with that, we've got testifiers here who can tell us a little more about the Monticello plant and the recent events. I'm very pleased to have Chris Clark, the president of Northern States Power and Minnesota Xcel Energy. Mr. Clark, if you're ready to approach and present your testimony, welcome back to the committee. Thank you for taking the time. Please identify yourself and fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joint chairs and committee members, appreciate the opportunity to be back in front of the committee today and give you a little bit of information. With me is Pat Flowers. I'll let Pat, you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Chairs, my name is Patrick Flowers. I'm a manager of environmental services for Xcel Energy.
So if it pleases the committee, what I would propose to do is to give you a quick overview. My expectation is many of you have heard pieces of this story. I'll just try to lay it out with a quick timeline and overview, share some of the interactions we've had an opportunity to have and some of the lessons that we've learned as a company going through this. So why don't I start with what really identified this issue for us, which was back in November, we identified in one of our monitoring wells, a well that's actually directly underneath the Monticello nuclear plant, that we were detecting tritium at elevated levels. That told us we likely had a leak in the plant that we needed to identify. So we began a very thorough process of investigating to find that leak. But upon finding the elevated tritium levels in that monitoring well, we did notify the NRC that day, as well as the state. We began our efforts, as I said, to find that leak. We knew that we were dealing with tritium. Tritium is an issue that the majority of operating nuclear power plants have dealt with and the NRC has dealt with, so there's experience in the industry. We knew that we weren't dealing with something that posed an immediate health or safety threat to the environment, to our surrounding communities, or to our employees even at the site. We do have a drinking water well on the site. We knew that we weren't picking up tritium in that well, so we were able to reassure our employees of that. As I said, we were able to keep operating the plant. Because we were operating the plant, that makes it, you know, harder to do the work to find the leak, but we did find the leak in December. It was actually in a very difficult to find spot between two buildings that are intentionally separated, but they're only separated by about a half inch gap. Each of those buildings has about a 2 foot thick concrete wall. We actually had to drill through that wall. We put a camera in, we were able to determine that that's where the leak was occurring. And once we had identified that leak, we were actually then able to cut part of the wall out and put a system in to catch that water. And then we were able to take that water with tritium that was continuing to leak and process that in our plant. At that point, we really turned our attention to dealing with the water that had leaked from the pipe and entered the groundwater. So our efforts really focused on understanding where that water was, this plume of tritiated water, and then figuring out what actions we needed to take to be able to recover that water with tritium. We worked with our groundwater experts and hydrologists. Obviously, we were sharing information at this point with the state agencies and the NRC as we went through this process. And then we did identify that we would benefit from having additional both monitoring and pumping wells. We, in January, were able to move to a strategy of getting those pumping wells and actually starting to remove the tritiated water from the ground, which really was in full swing by February. That has allowed us to remove about 38% of the tritiated water from the ground. And of course, as this goes into the groundwater, it begins to dissipate, but it's in a plume and we're able to identify where that plume is. based on the other monitoring wells we have around the plant. So I mentioned that we identified it from a well that was directly underneath the plant, but then we also have a series of wells around the plant and then farther out from that and then up next to the river. And this allows us to really have an understanding of, you know, what's going on with that tritiated water in the groundwater. So we have been successfully removing that water, storing it where we can either process it in the plant or work with the state agencies on other things that we can do with that water. But our focus has really been on that recovery. As we went through this process and had more interaction with both the state agencies and the local community, we were encouraged by both the agencies and the community to share more about what was going on at the plant site. As I said, there wasn't a danger to public safety or health, but there was more activity. We have the trucks coming in to store the water. We knew that we were going to have more activity at the upcoming outage in April, and so we made the decision to come forward and provide more information to the public. We had a couple of already scheduled public hearings, one with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for subsequent license renewal of the Monticello plant, and then another one for the state process for a certificate of need. We also had two public open houses that the state agencies participated in us with, where we were able to have local residents could come and ask us questions, ask the agencies questions, and that provided us a good opportunity to show members of the public what was going on, to answer their questions, and then also to have obviously not only experts from our company there, but expertise from the state agencies, which I think was very helpful and very appreciated by the public. Obviously, one of the pieces of feedback we've received through this, and as a real lesson learned for us, is that even though this was something that was contained to our site and didn't present a public health risk, people wanted us to be sharing more information sooner. And, you know, we have the benefit of operating two large generating plants in central Minnesota, both our Sherco plant over in Becker and this Monticello nuclear plant. We have great support from central Minnesota. We don't want to take that for granted. We want to be a good neighbor. And so I think we've definitely learned lessons there about working with the communities that have been so supportive of us to have a better process, to share information, help people understand what's going on, and be able to have their questions answered. So we appreciate, as I said, the support and the cooperation of the state agencies in working through these issues. I'll just touch on one other issue just to hit the timeline and then open ourselves up for questions here. We did, I said we put that system in to catch the water. We did identify in March that some of that water, instead of being caught, was spilling over. So essentially think of having a container to catch water at a leak from a pipe at your house, and some of the water is spilling over. That's actually a second leak under the state rules. We reported it. And then we did decide to bring the plant down after that leak, and then we cut the section of pipe out between those two buildings. We've sent that to a lab for a full after-action metallurgic analysis to understand why it failed. We also cut out a second pipe. That'll also give us a reference, but, you know, sort of a belt and suspenders to make sure that we've eliminated the issue and that those pipes aren't leaking. The plant was returned to service. It will come down this Friday evening for a scheduled refueling outage, which will last about a month. We'll do some additional inspections, obviously, while we're down for that outage. So just wanted to mention that. Obviously, we're sharing all this information with the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, as well as continuing to work constructively with the state agencies. And again, appreciate the opportunity to be here and answer questions. And so with that, Pat and I would be happy to answer questions. I do have other expertise here from the company if there are detailed questions about nuclear operations or other things that would be helpful.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. We have two other testifiers that I think we'll bring forward. You can keep your seats in case Okay. Members have questions. So members, if we're okay with this, let's have the other two testifiers then go to member questions and any other testimony. With that, we'd like to invite Assistant Commissioner Kudelka up from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And Mr. Huff from the Department of Health. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Mr. Commissioner Cadell, can I have you listed first? I assume that's okay. If you could please introduce yourself and present your testimony. And members, if you have not seen in your packet, also we have the overhead views just as part of the testimony today. Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, fire away.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and work on land issues. I'm going to quickly turn it over to my colleague at the Department of Health.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Huff. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Department of Health.
So thank you, chairs and committee members. We're going to partner a little bit here on the testimony and cover a couple things. One is just the overall process and how information was coming into the agency and our thought process during the activities. I'll handle that information about the investigation of the groundwater and also the remediation efforts. Turn it over to my colleague who will talk about drinking water and overall questions about health risk potentially from the contaminant, and then follow up with just some lessons learned and those likes. So I'll start off and just note in general, the process to investigate and remediate a contamination or release is an iterative process. This takes time, and this is what happened and played out in the same case here with the Xcel Monticello facility. For example, all the information we shared in the public release on March 16th was assembled over a period of months. This is not all available when we first learned about the detection of tritium in the groundwater in November. So that November 22nd date is when the state duty officer is informed by Xcel that tritium is found in the well underneath their facility. The state duty officer, what they do is they collect that information and then share that with other entities depending on the potential characteristics of a release or a leak. At that time, the information was shared with other agencies such as MPCA, Department of Health, DNR, Public Safety, Wright County. In addition, Xcel informed NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the federal level, which also posted it on their website. It's at this point that we start the investigation, and it's really the company's duty here to start collecting and sharing the information and taking those actions. And that's, you know, how we are starting to piece together what has occurred, whether it's the magnitude of the contamination, where it's located, where the leak is, and the cleanup process overall and communications. The agency's roles are for oversight and advice during that process, and only if a party is not able to do that work does the state step in and do that work. In this case, we have a cooperative party that's working to investigate and do the cleanup. So I just want to go over, you know, how we over the months pieced together what was occurring. I mentioned the first notice in late November of the detection underneath the facility and the contaminated groundwater. Just in general then, in December, we learned that the source of the leak is found and steps were being taken to control and captured, which Xcel outlined on how they were doing that, and that permanent repairs would be made in the scheduled downtime in April. At the very end of December is the first indication, too, that we had a little movement in plume where another well picked it up for the first time. In the case here of the Xcel facility, this is all happening information gathering much quicker because they have a system of wells built out around the facility to aid this information. So information is coming in much quicker than a normal type of release or contamination where we're not having to put in wells and the like. And so while we say there's movement, we're really only talking about 150 feet, just further north and running parallel to the river. In December, we have well sampling around the facility and the like, showing that it has not moved off site and that any impact to drinking water wells on site, that there is no impact. All those are showing non-detect. As noted then, in January is when the company starts taking on the recovery of the groundwater and storing it temporarily on site, the contaminated groundwater, or putting it back into its facility as use of its regular operations. At the same time, it's in mid-January, we first get a detection on a well that's closer to the river than previously. However, while it's closer to the river, the plume's movement, we have even between that well and the river another series of wells that are showing non-detects. So showing no information at that time that it was getting to the river. At this time, the state agencies are also checking in with Xcel and asking them how are they communicating with local governments and being informed that they have had conversations with local units of government. Again, well sampling is showing that the contamination has not left the site, The drinking water well on site is testing with non-detection, and so there's not a concern of a risk to drinking water. February is where we start to collect some more information on this. Pumping wells continue to operate. Part of those wells are to remove the contaminated groundwater from underneath the facility. In addition, there are a number of control wells that are being used and pumped to stabilize the plume and prevent it from moving any further. Those materials, that contaminated groundwater, is then being put in temporary storage at the facility, and we've been working with the company on that issue. This is also where we are getting our first estimates of what the potential amount of the leak is. Many have heard the 400,000 gallons of water that is what is believed to be released. And that's, as we're starting to put together the pieces, how we start to get these numbers. Again, in February, the well sampling on site is showing that it has not moved off site and no impacts to drinking water wells. And it's at this point where the agency is working with Xcel have determined we have sufficient information to be able to share this with more folks to make them aware of what is occurring. In general, the agencies have a couple areas where we are doing sharing information. And one is if there is an imminent or current risk to anyone's public health, say impacts of drinking water or vapor intrusion. And throughout this process, there had not been that occurring. If it had occurred, there was a current or imminent risk, the public would have been informed. Our next check-in of sharing this information with folks is where we have sufficient information to be able to answer folks' questions. It's a balancing act the agencies must do in this type of disclosure. Presenting too little information with very little detail ends up creating the potential for fear when we're not able to answer questions and anxiety. So what we try to do is find that balance. And in March, we believe we've come to that point and worked with Xcel to jointly share the information on March 16th. As mentioned, after then, a week later, with the fix for the leak itself had sprung a problem and was then repaired permanently as outlined by Xcel and the facility going down. At the same time, there was a fish kill, and this is anticipated. When a facility like the Xcel nuclear facility does shut down, we have seen that because of the change in the water temperature going to the river, we do anticipate fish kills, and that did occur. Just like we are expecting a fish kill with the scheduled downtime coming up later this week because of that temperature change, not because of any contamination that's causing this issue. So with that, I'm going to pass it on to my colleague at the Department of Health. I'll talk just in general more about the risk profile of tritium and other issues such as groundwater.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka. Assistant Commissioner Hupp, welcome to the committee. Let us have your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Herr, committee members. So I wanted to start off to talk about the health risk that we associate with tritium. Whenever we look at any source of contamination, we look at the substance itself, what are the pathways, what are the risks to human health, and then we also look at where it is present, at what concentration it is present, and does it reach those levels that we would be of concern for human health. So tritium is radioactive. However, when we talk about a radioactive substance, it's important to distinguish what type of radiation we're talking about. This is not gamma radiation, which is very dangerous and can cause burns and radiation burns. This is very low energy radiation, and we call it ionizing radiation that releases what's called a beta particle. Now, a beta particle from tritium could not penetrate this sheet of paper here because it's very low energy. It's the same as with radon that we have, that we know in Minnesota is naturally occurring in a lot of folks' homes. However, with high exposure, we do have a risk for cancer. And the reason is, even though it will not penetrate my outer skin, mainly because I have a level, a layer of dead cells here in my epidermis, when if I were to ingest it, or in the case of radon, breathe it in, the cells that line both my lungs and my digestive system are endothelial cells, and they don't have that outer layer of epithelial that, say, my skin does. that one layer of cells can be penetrated by the beta particle. Beta particles can, if they were to hit exactly in the right place, damage DNA. And then that is where you have a cancer risk. The more beta particle exposure, then the higher risk. It is determined that for tritium, the drinking water standard, because really in order to get tritium, you need to drink it. Tritium is a hydrogen atom. It actually binds with oxygen and is part of the water. So it's not like it's mixed in the water. It is the water. It's part of the hydrogen, part of the water molecule. So if I were to drink that, then it could expose those internal, those endothelial cells to beta particles. The EPA drinking water standard is 20,000 picocuries per liter per year. And that's measured if I didn't drink anything else except that water. If I had it at above 20,000 picocuries per liter, that would increase my risk of cancer. And therefore, that's what the drinking water standard is set at. So that's the standard itself. We then look at what are the exposure risks. And as Assistant Commissioner Kodalka said, the current plume of the tritiated water is underneath the plant. We at MDH look at, well, what are those sources where it might get into drinking water? And so we look at what are those wells that are around the plant or around that plume. The closest well is actually Xcel's own drinking water well that they use for the drinking water supply in the plant for the workers there. And that is 6/10 of a mile from the plume or from the leak, and it is side gradient. So when we think of groundwater, the groundwater moves towards the river. This well is to the side. Here's the river, here's the plume, here's the well. We would not anticipate that the plume would move towards that well, but it is possible, especially, you know, with flooding and moving migration of the of the groundwater, but very unlikely. Therefore, we and Xcel is monitoring that well and sharing those results with us so that we can make sure that that does not exceed the drinking water standard. And right now, there's nothing but background level in that well. We also have looked at what are the other wells that are in the area, and the closest wells are over a mile away, so these are private individual wells, and they are up gradient. So we do not anticipate that this plume would ever reach those wells. The other potential source for drinking water would be from the river itself, and downstream, the first community to take water in from the river for drinking water is St. Paul, followed by Minneapolis. If this whole 400,000 gallons of water were to make it into the Mississippi all at once, which is not going to happen because if it were to reach the river, it would slowly flow in. We know it hasn't reached the river due to, as Assistant Commissioner Kodalka said, we have monitoring wells between the plume and the river. But if, by the time that reached Minneapolis or St. Paul's intake, the amount of radiation that's contained would be well below drinking water standard and probably not even detectable. Because the river, is millions of gallons a minute flow, it would be completely diluted out. So we do not have a concern for it impacting drinking water either in St. Paul or Minneapolis or in surrounding private wells that are offside of Xcel property. And as I mentioned, the very closest well is that Xcel well that is being monitored, and we do not anticipate that that flow would impact that well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner Huff. That ends our scheduled testifiers. Are there any members of the public who did not notify the committee administrators that they wanted to testify? Seeing none, thank you all for your testimony. Stay right where you are. I'd like to go to member questions. The chairs have a couple, but let's give members an opportunity first. Senator Wiesenberg.
Thank you, Chair. And I guess this is maybe just for people around the Monticello area, and I'm You said that the drinking water at the plant is safe, so are they drinking that water then from the plant wells? Just to clarify so people in the area feel safe to drink their water.
Thanks, Senator. Is that for any particular testifier?
Anybody who can answer it. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Perhaps. Commissioner Huff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, the water that residents of Monticello is drinking is safe. There is no, the closest Monticello well is 3.3 miles away from the plume. So it would, there's really no risk from this plume reaching that well. The private well that Xcel has only supplies the Xcel's facility there at Monticello. It's not a considered, you know, a public well. It is a well for people at the facility.
Thanks, Assistant Commissioner. Any follow-up, Senator?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I guess my question was, are you drinking that water there currently, or are we still monitoring that water there, is what I was wondering. So are the people at Monticello plant drinking that water?
Commissioner Huff.
Thank you.
Thanks, Senator.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator. And I may defer as well to colleagues at Xcel. There are no detectable limits of tritium in that well. So that well is currently in use, as far as we know, as MDH. And there is not concern from current monitoring at that well. And I'll turn it over to Xcel as to how they use that water.
Yeah, I agree, Commissioner, and that is correct. Our employees are drinking from that. We have let our employees know, you know, obviously that we're working on this tritium issue, but we've also let them know that we're monitoring that well to assure them that that drinking water is safe for them.
Thanks, Mr. Clark. Thanks, Sister yep. Mr. Huff. Senator Wiesenberger, I just, any follow-up?
Yeah. I don't have a question. I guess I wanted the public to hear that, then they'll feel better is all. Okay. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. We have Senator Zhang, and then we'll go to Senator Kunesh. Senator Zhang.
Thank you, Chair Friends. Maybe for Commissioner Huff, you talked a bit about, you know, that we talked about Monticello area, the drinking water, and maybe in the metro area. Are there other communities that could be impacted along the path from Monticello down to here?
Mr. Huff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Zhang, there would be two pathways for this water to impact drinking water. And one is through groundwater migration and impacting a well. So the Monticello, the city of Monticello municipal well, the closest is 3.3 miles away. So that would be highly unlikely that it would ever reach there. So the only drinking water well that we think is potentially at risk, and I would say it's a low risk, is the Xcel drinking water well I mentioned. And then if you look downriver, we could anticipate that river water will impact, especially more shallow groundwater, but we do not see it to impact any groundwater wells that are used for drinking once it hits the river or if it hits the river. And those first two communities that take water from the river directly are St. Paul, followed by Minneapolis for their intakes.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Zhang, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Commissioner Huffman. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Senator Zhang. We're going to go to Senator Kunesh, then I have Senator Mitchell, then I have Senator Weber. Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have used the word plume a number of times, and when I think of plume, especially when it comes to a nuclear plant, I'm thinking airborne substances. So would it be, if you're using that word in that way, are you saying that this is it tritium, has now become airborne? And no. So maybe you can explain how that word plume is being used in this context. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh. Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, maybe that's in your lane.
Yep. Thank you, Chair and committee members. When we talk about plumes, we often talk about groundwater plumes, and that's just what we're talking about is where the contamination is as a whole underneath the ground, and we refer to it as plumes there, not in terms of any impacts to air or anything else. the way groundwater plumes could impact air quality, we refer to it as vapor issues, and we don't have any concerns with vapor issues with tritium like we would other contaminants such as TCE or PERC.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Kunesh?
Thank you for that explanation. And just one last question about the fish kill. So are you saying that every time that there's the plant puts some kind of water or some kind of liquid into the river because of the temperature change that there is always a fish kill? And like, what are we talking about when it comes to fish kill?
Thanks, Senator. Assistant Commissioner Kudelka, are you good with that question?
I could start off.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. You know, I just want to elaborate that Department of Health and MPCA are part of four agencies that work together, and the other is DNR and really works on this here. So I'm just going to refer to some of the stuff that they have done. It is typical it happens. It doesn't mean it always happens. It has happened in the past, but we know there's questions about this fish kill, if it was connected in any way to the contaminated groundwater getting into the river. And we just want to be clear that looking at the fish kill that did occur is because of differences in the temperature of the water that may occur again, and would not be surprising if it happens, but it doesn't mean it will happen either.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Kunesh? Okay. We have the DNR here. I think if we needed to call them up later, Senator Kunesh, with that, I think we'll go to Senator Mitchell. Senator Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two totally separate questions, just as a warning. First, I have a community with PFAS, for example, and plumes that move around in our water, and it's been really hard to track and follow and stay on top of, in part because the levels of what is acceptable as we have more science and learn more about it have gone down over time, right? So we've learned about cumulative effects on the body, causing more cancers, things of that nature. Is tritium something else where the current level, as we've learned more, has gone down over time, or has it been a pretty constant level of what is considered acceptable?
Thank you, Senator. Maybe we'll give that to Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Whoever wants to answer it.
Department of Health, fire away.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's a great question. And so with PFAS, we're actually learning a lot every day because these are newer chemicals that are studied. When we look at tritium, we don't think of it as tritium, we think of it as radiation. And so we look at what is the radiation exposure. If you were to exceed the drinking water limit, which is at 20,000 picocuries per liter over a year, you would be exposed to approximately 4 millirems of radiation. To give context for that, a chest X-ray is about 10 millirems of radiation. We are exposed to radiation in the environment. We're exposed to tritium radiation in the environment. Tritium is naturally formed in the atmosphere. It is also left over from nuclear weapons testing in the 50s and 60s. So we do have background levels of tritium currently in the environment that we detect. It is unlikely that the standard for tritium would change as PFAS is changing, because the science around radiation is fairly well known, and we look at it from a radiation exposure. Now, no radiation, you know, would be ideal if we didn't have any radiation exposure. We get some from the sun, from different activities, and, you know, the advantage of having a chest X-ray is that that's medically needed. Exposure to tritium, if it were to come from a nuclear power plant, we want that to be zero. So that's why we are definitely focused in on this issue. But I do not anticipate at this time that the standard would change, because we're really looking at overall radiation exposure.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Senator Mitchell, you said you had two questions.
If that's okay. Second, totally different question. My understanding is that nuclear releases are currently exempted from the Minnesota Environmental Response Liability Act. And even us here in the legislature, we found out about the leak the same time the public did, even though it had been ongoing for a while. So given that there's usually federal preemption regulation of nuclear plants, does that give us here at the legislature any ability to regulate in this area or even to be informed in a more timely manner?
Thanks, Senator Mitchell. Any particular testifier you want to send that to?
Whoever's game.
Mr. Clark, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka.
Perhaps I'll start and then have the agencies perhaps join in if they desire. So with regard to the reporting, so we did report immediately to the NRC and to the state agencies. I think the missing element that we've really identified in working with our neighbors in the community and engaging and getting feedback like we're getting here is that we don't expect our neighbors to be looking at the NRC website every day. And so I think as a company, one of the lessons we're taking from this is to continue working with the agencies, with the city, with the county as our neighbors, and determine how we can do a better job of sharing information about about having a nuclear power plant, about what's going on at our nuclear power plants in the communities that they're in here in Minnesota. So I don't know that I'm directly answering your legal question, but as a matter of practice, I think that's a lesson that all of us have learned. We want to be responsible in how we're providing information, but I think we've identified plenty of opportunities to be in a position to provide more information in a more timely manner to the communities. We are regulated by the NRC. The NRC has an extensive history of working with tritium at nuclear power plants. The majority of nuclear power plants have addressed issues around tritium. That helps us in that it provides a body of knowledge around this, and it gives both the NRC and the agencies knowledge from those previous incidences to be helpful. I think that's also information we can be sharing with the public as we're dealing with a situation like this. We view ourselves as a business who's here in Minnesota to provide a public service, to provide the necessary electric and gas service that our customers need. We want to be that responsible party. That's why we're working closely with the agencies to make sure that we're doing what we need to remediate this, but also that we're learning the lessons here about providing better information to our neighbors in the community.
Thanks, Mr. Clark. Senator Mitchell.
Thank you for the answer. I'm not sure I heard a piece if there's anything more that we could be doing at a state level.
You're good for now, Senator Mitchell?
I'm good for now.
All right. Well, I do have a question to follow up, and I know we have Senator Weber and Senator Matthews waiting, but I guess the question would be, does the NRC regulate the minimum information that the utility must provide or put a limit on how much you can tell the public, or is it nuanced? Any information you could share? For example, in November, could XL have said, hey, everybody, or does that violate some federal regulation that Senator Mitchell's sort of driving at? Obviously, one of the points we're looking at here is what could the state legislature do to try to combine the interests of the public's right to know with our need to continue to produce safe energy and anything else that the legislators thinks important. That was a long-winded way of saying, does the NRC have a minimum limit of disclosure or a maximum or anywhere in between?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, we reported to the NRC the day we identified the elevated tritium levels in the well. I think that is our obligation and the expectation of the NRC with us. The NRC, to my knowledge, actually encourages utilities who operate nuclear power plants or other entities that operate nuclear power plants to be sharing information about what's happening at the plants with the public in a manner that is helpful to the public. So obviously they don't want us creating unnecessary concern, and I think that's the balance that the state agencies here spoke of. So I think I guess to answer your question, there are limits on certain informations regarding nuclear security that are prohibitions, but there are very few of those and certainly not relevant to the case before us here.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Very much to the point. We have Senator Weber and then Senator Matthews. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2XL, you mentioned, I believe, that you had taken that section of the pipe where the leak occurred and another section where there was no leak and sent that off for testing purposes. Are you expecting to have the results of those tests back in time so that if there was a problem shown on a broader scale of pipe deterioration, that you can solve that during and replace that during your 30-day shutdown period coming up?
Thank you, Senator Weber. Mr. Clark.
Yes, so we did send those out for the metallurgic analysis. We expect that to take 30 to 60 days. You know, I expect the full root cause analysis will continue on after we complete this outage. We did do a series of inspections when we brought the plant down to cut those two pipe sections out and replace them. We did replace them with a stainless steel material, which should be more robust. And then we also inspected other piping that ran between those two buildings. We'll do additional thorough inspections while we're down for the longer period during the refueling outage. And then we'll also take the lessons learned that we get later after we're back online from that. So, you know, we won't have the full set of information when we come down for this refueling outage, but we will do everything we can during this refueling outage to complete those inspections, and then we'll take that additional information when we get it and determine if we need to take other actions, either while the plant is operating or, if necessary, bring the plant down to make any other repairs.
Thanks, Mr. Clark. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming in the construction of a nuclear plant that the contractors used are very specialized in dealing with materials that are resistant to breakdown due to exposure of radiation and that type of thing. Am I correct? Are there many companies that can work on the plant, or are you limited in the companies that are qualified to work on such a plant?
Mr. Clark.
So it's a complex answer. I would say that, you know, there are areas of a nuclear plant which are highly specialized, which there are very few vendors that are qualified to do. There are other areas of a power plant which are much like the other power plants on our system. So just to give you a sense, when we come down for this outage on Friday night, we bring in about 600 to 800 additional members of the trades to work at the plant through the outage to perform all sorts of different kinds of maintenance at all sorts of different skill levels. So we use all sorts of different trades when we're doing this, from the highly specialized down to the working on routine wiring and piping and equipment through the plant. So it's quite a mix. It's actually a big plant and quite complex, as you would expect.
Thanks, thank Mr. you. Clark. Senator Weber?
Nope, I'm good. Thank
All
you.
Right. Thank you, Senator Weber. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our testifiers for sharing, representing I'm the closest district to the Monticello site here, and had a number of communications throughout this process. And the one question that I think I got answered today that was unanswered through this whole time was why the wait from the agency's standpoint from the November incident to the date in March when you decided to give the information to the public. But I do think you laid out well the steps to that, and would be cautious, members, we can consider if additional regulations needed, but I'd be cautious because I don't want to paint with a broad brush if you use your judgment, and perhaps we'd do it differently if we were redoing from November on, but I don't think any two circumstances or situations are going to be the same, and we don't want to cause more harm than the good that we're trying to solve. And so I am heartened by the fact that everyone here is saying we've learned some things and we are putting on ourselves ways that we'll do it differently down the road, which I am grateful for. My second point, which will lead into a question, is this shows all these safety mechanisms that are in place to catch this for this very reason before anything like all these wells that are surrounding the plant that are there to catch something before it will reach the river or before it will reach the public drinking source. And so I just want to highlight that you've put those safety precautions in place for this very reason, to be that buffer to make sure that you will see it and you can fix it before it gets into a public river or into drinking water. So highlighting that, and my follow-up question to Excel then is, what's the status of these wells moving forward? Are they reusable past one incident being caught? Will you have to put in new wells for the future, or are these able to be cleaned up and continue to use for future monitoring? What does this buffer and what does this protection layer look like moving forward? Will that have to be rebuilt or replaced?
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, Senator Matthews. So this network of wells has really been there for quite some time, but we did add additional wells as part of this. So we added, I think, 11 or 12 additional wells, both for monitoring and for pumping. All of these wells will continue to be useful to us as we monitor for the future. Obviously, we're working to pull the tritiated water from the ground. We believe we've pulled about 38% of that water from the ground at this point. But we will work with the state agencies then to establish a baseline level against which we're measuring so that we would know if we have a future event. And to your point about redundant safety systems, the other part of our after-action analysis at the plant will be to identify whether other systems could have or should have told us that we were experiencing a leak before we identified tritium in the well. So the wells will continue to be useful for future monitoring, and then we will also determine whether other systems could give us an even earlier indicator for our future operations. We also share that, of course, with our other plant at Prairie Island and then with the rest of the nuclear industry as part of industry sharing of lessons.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Senator Matthews? All right. Members, Senator Kunesh.
Thank you. And just a quick follow-up on that. Can you tell us if this sort of leak or defect in the pipe that's used, has that happened either here in Minnesota in the past or nationally? I mean, is this something that is often occurring or sometimes occurring? Is it something that you have to really keep a close eye on?
Thank you, Senator Kunesh. I don't know if Mr. Clark wants to tackle that or Mr. Kadelka.
I'll, again, happy Mr. to Clark. Start and then appreciate
sure.
any additional comments from the agencies. Mr. Chair, Senator Kunesh, tritium is an issue that the majority of operating nuclear plants have dealt with. The leaks have tended to be for different causes. We had a previous leak at Monticello that was really from water that had entered the sump pump system in the plant. We actually relined all of those sumps as part of that, learning from that. This is actually a different scenario here where we've had the pipe in this fairly difficult to reach area between the two buildings. We'll share that. The industry, as I said, shares these lessons across the industry, but tritium is something that the majority of nuclear plants have dealt with. As the Department of Health explained, we know the risk level of this compared to the other radiation levels we have at the plant, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has looked at each incident of tritium release that's occurred. They'll do that again with us here, and then obviously we'll continue working with the state agencies to ensure that we're taking the proper precautions going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Senator Kunesh, any follow-up? Senator, I did think earlier on there was some reporting that of the 57 nuclear facilities in the nation, 40 at one time or another have reported a tritium leak of one type or another, not to your question about what caused them, but that gave some context to how frequently that might happen. Anyway, you're good for now, Senator Kunesh. All right. Members, thanks for taking the time. To our testifiers, thanks very much. A couple of highlights I caught from this before I hand it over to Senator Herr. Appreciate the agencies referring to XL as a cooperative party. I think that's what we're looking for, not just in this committee, but in this Capitol. Work together, get better results, everybody happy, that type of thing. To XL, I'd say thanks for being forthcoming. You know, we're trying to ask these questions because that's our job. Government's number one duty is to keep people safe. I think your questions have been direct and honest and to the point. And the final comment I wrote down from the Department of Health was we do not have a concern from a drinking water standpoint, and I appreciate that candor. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Senator Herr, who's going to have some closing remarks and then adjourn us. Thank you again.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming to present to us about the leakage of tritium. And I just thought, you know, since DNR is here, and earlier Senator Kunesh did ask about Fishkill, does the DNR want to make a comment or informational remarks before I do a final closure?
On behalf of the fish.
On behalf of the fish, yes. Yes, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Brad Parsons. I'm the Fisheries Section Manager for the Division of Fish and Wildlife in DNR. If would you like me just to address what I heard from the senator and some various... Okay.
Yes.
Well, it was talked about that XL is a partner in this. They do employ a team of scientists, biologists, who went out and looked at this. The mechanism is really thermal shock is basically what it is, because warmer water is coming out of power plants, and that's a common thing everywhere, not just with nuclear. So if that warm water stops, fish receive a thermal shock. There were somewhere under 300 fish that were discovered dead, a variety of species, including some game fish and some of our other native fish, smallmouth bass, channel catfish, etc. We have a preliminary report from XL that looks quite good. There is a reimbursement for killed fish. It's not considered a penalty or a fine. It's a reimbursement to the state of Minnesota, because the people of the state of Minnesota own the fish and wildlife. So we were comfortable with the way the kill was handled. It is not uncommon, particularly in the wintertime. It's not great, but it is not uncommon, Senator. Mr. Yes. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for the answer. I know that Senator Kunesh did post that question early on, and I just thought before we close this hearing, joint committee hearing, you know, want to hear some report. So thank you, Mr. Parson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you to Mr. Clark, Mr. Flower, and our Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, and also Assistant Commissioner Hoff for being here as well. So thank you, members, for being here, and our joint committee meeting is adjourned. That's it.